his head, hesitated, then ran her fingernails down his secondary spine. Nessus made a sound of delight. She turned and walked upstairs. Not once did she glance back. She seemed to assume that Nessus would follow like a dog, and he did. Good, thought Louis. Be subservient. Make her trust you. But when the oddly matched sounds of their footsteps faded away, the cell block became a tremendous tomb. Speaker was 30 feet away across the Sargasso Sea of metal. 4 padded black fingers and a puff of orange face showed around the green crash balloons. Louis had no way of getting near. The Kazin might be dead already. Among the white bones below were at least a dozen skulls. Bones, and age, and rusted metal, and silence. Louis Wu clung to his cycle and waited for his strength to give out. He was dozing, not many minutes later, when something changed. His balance shifted. Louis's life depended on his balance. The momentary disorientation sent him into a rigid panic. He looked wildly about him, moving only his eyes. The metal vehicles were all around him, motionless. But something was moving. A distant car bumped, screeched like tearing metal, and went up. Huh? No, it had grounded against the upper ring of cells. The whole Sargasso was sinking uniformly through space. One by one, noisily, the cars and flying packs docked and were left behind. Louis' cycle smacked jarringly into concrete, turned half round in the turbulence of the electromagnetic forces, and toppled. Louis let go and rolled clear. Immediately he was trying to get to his feet, but he couldn't get his balance. He couldn't stay upright. His hands were claws, contorted with pain, useless. He lay panting on his side, thinking that it must already be too late. Speaker's flycycle must have landed on Speaker. Speaker's flycycle, easily recognizable, lay on its side, 2 tiers up. Speaker was there, and he wasn't under the cycle. He must have been under it before the cycle fell on its side, but even then the balloons would have protected him to some extent. Louis reached him by crawling. The Kazin was alive and breathing, but unconscious. The weight of the fly cycle had not broken his neck, possibly because he didn't really have a neck. Louis clawed the flashlight laser from his belt, used its green needle beam to free Speaker from his balloons. Now what? Louis remembered that he was dying of thirst. His head seemed to have stopped spinning. He stood, wobbly-legged, to look for the only functional water source he knew. The cell block was all concentric circular ledges, each ledge the roof of a ring of cell blocks. Speaker had grounded on the 4th ring from the center. Louis found one cycle with tattered crash balloon fabric draped across it. There was another, 1 tier down and across the central pit, equipped with a human-style saddle. The third... Nessus's cycle had grounded a tier below Speaker's. Louis went down to it. His feet jarred him as they hit the steps. His muscles were too tired to absorb the shock. He shook his head at the sight of the dashboard. Nobody would be stealing Nessus's fly cycle. The controls were incredibly cryptic. But he did identify the water spout. The water was warm, tasteless as distilled water, and utterly delicious. When Louis had quenched his thirst, he tried a brick from the kitchen slot. It tasted very strange. Louis decided not to eat it yet. There might be additives deadly to human metabolism. Nessus would know. He carried water to Speaker in his shoe, the first container he thought of. He dribbled it into the Kazin's mouth, and the Kazin swallowed it in his sleep and smiled. Louis went back for another load and ran out of stamina before he could reach the puppeteer's fly cycle. So he curled up on the flat construction plastic and closed his eyes. Safe. He was safe. He should have been asleep instantly, the way he felt, but something nagged at him. Abused muscles, cramps in hands and thighs, the fear of falling that would not let him go even now, and something more. He sat up. No justice, he mumbled. Speaker? The Kazin was sleeping curled around himself, with his ears tight to his head and his slaver weapon hugged tight to his belly, so that only the double snout showed. His breathing was regular but very fast. Was that good? Nessus would know. Meanwhile, let him sleep. No justice, Louis repeated under his breath. He was alone and lonely, without the advantage of being on sabbatical. He was responsible for the well-being of others. His own life and health depended on how well Nessus gulled the crazy half-bald woman who was keeping them prisoner. Small wonder if he couldn't sleep. Still, his eyes found it and locked. His own fly cycle. His own fly cycle with the broken crash balloons trailing, and Nessus's fly cycle here beside him, and Speaker's fly cycle beside Speaker, and the fly cycle with the human-shaped saddle, and no crash balloons. Four fly cycles. Frantic for water, he'd missed the implications the first time round. Now, Teela's fly cycle. It must have been behind one of the bigger vehicles. And no crash balloons. No crash balloons. She must have fallen off when the cycle turned over. Or been torn away when the sonic fold failed at Mach 2. What was it Nessus had said? Her luck is clearly undependable. And Speaker. If her luck had failed her just once, she would be dead. She was dead. She must be. I came with you because I love you. Bad luck, said Louis Wu. Bad luck you met me. He curled up on the concrete and slept. Much later, he woke with a jolt to find Speaker to Animals looking down into his face. The lurid orange fur mask made his eyes doubly prominent, and there was a wistful look. Speaker asked, Can you eat the Leaf Eater's food? I'm afraid to try, said Louis. The vast, echoing cavity of his belly suddenly made all his other problems trivial, except one. I think that of the three of us, I alone have no food supply, said the Kazin. That wistful look. The hair stood up on Louis's neck. In a steady voice, he said, You know you have a food supply. The question is, will you use it? Certainly not, Louis. If honor requires me to starve within reach of meat, then I will starve. Good. Louis turned over and pretended to go back to sleep. And when he woke up some hours later, he knew that he had been asleep. His hind brain, he decided, must trust Speaker's word completely. If the Kazin said he would starve, he would starve. His bladder was full, and there was a stink in his nostrils, and his muscles ached obtrusively. The pit solved one problem, and the puppeteer's fly cycle supplied water to wash the muck off his sleeve. Then Louis limped down a flight of steps to reach his own fly cycle and first aid kit. But the kit was not a simple box of medicines. It mixed dosages on command and made its own diagnoses. A complex machine. And the zap guns had burnt it out. The light was fading. Cells with trapdoors over them, and small transparent panes around the trapdoors. Louis dropped to his belly to look into a cell. Bed, peculiar-looking toilet, and daylight coming through a picture window. Speaker, Louis called. They used the disintegrator to break in. The picture window was big and rectangular, a strange luxury for a prison cell. The glass was gone but for a few sharp crystal teeth around the edges. Windows to taunt the prisoner, to show him freedom? The window faced a port. It was half daylight. The shadow of the Terminator was coming in from spinward like a black curtain. Ahead was the harbor. Cubes that must be warehouses, rotting docks, cranes of elegantly simplistic design, and one tremendous ground effect ship in dry dock. All rust-red skeletons. To left and right stretched mile after mile of twisting shore. A stretch of beach, then a line of docks, then a stretch of beach. The scheme must have been built into the shore itself. A stretch of shallow beach like Waikiki, then deep water meeting steep shore, perfect for a harbor, then more shallow beach. Beyond, the ocean. It seemed to go on forever, until it faded in the infinity horizon. Try to look across the Atlantic. Dusk came on like a curtain, right to left. The surviving lights of the Civic Center brightened, while city and dock and ocean merged in darkness. To anti-spinward, the golden light of day still glowed. And Speaker had copped the cell's oval bed. Louis smiled. He looked so peaceful, the Kazin warrior. Sleeping away his injuries, was he? The burns must have weakened him. Or was he trying to sleep away his growing hunger? Louis left him there. In the near darkness of the prison, he found Nessus's cycle. His hunger was such that he choked down a food brick intended for a puppeteer gullet, ignoring the peculiar taste. The gloom had begun to bother him, so he turned on the headlamps on the puppeteer's fly cycle, then hunted down the other fly cycles and turned them on too. By the time he finished, the place was pretty bright, and all the shadows were intricate and strange. What was taking Nessus so long? There wasn't much entertainment in the ancient floating prison. You could spend just so much time sleeping, and Louis had used his quota. You could spend just so much time wondering what the tonge the puppeteer was doing up there before you began to wonder if he was selling you out. After all, Nessus wasn't just an alien. He was a Pearson's puppeteer with a record a mile long for manipulating humans to his own ends. If he could reach an understanding with a presumed Ringworld engineer, he might abandon Louis and Speaker right now, no hesitation. A puppeteer might have no reason not to. And there were two good reasons why he should. Speaker to animals would almost certainly make some last-ditch attempt to take the long shot from Louis Wu, to reserve the second quantum hyperdrive for Kazinti alone. A puppeteer could get hurt in the resulting battle. Safer to leave Speaker now. And to leave Louis Wu, because he probably wouldn't stand for such a betrayal. Besides, they knew too much. With Teela dead, only Speaker and Louis knew about the puppeteer experiments in guided evolution. The starseed lure, the fertility laws. If Nessus had been ordered to divulge such information to gauge his crewmate's reactions, probably he had also been ordered to abandon them sometime during the trip. These were not even new thoughts. Louis had been alert for some such action ever since Nessus had admitted to guiding an outsider ship to Procyon via starseed lure. His paranoia was justified in a way, but there wasn't a tonge thing he could do about it. To save his mind, Louis broke into another cell. He cut across suspected locks with his flashlight laser turned to high and narrow, and on the fourth try the door came up. A terrible stench came up, too. Louis held his breath, stuck his head and his flashlight laser in long enough to find out why. Someone had died in there after the ventilation had quit. The corpse was hunched up against the picture window with a heavy pitcher in his hand. The pitcher was broken. The window was intact. The cell next door proved to be empty. Louis took possession. He had crossed the pit to get a cell with a starboard view. He could see the rolling hurricane directly before him. Its size was respectable, considering that they had left it 2,500 miles behind. A big, brooding blue eye. To spinward was a tall, narrow, floating building as big as a passenger starship. Briefly, Louis daydreamed that it was a starship, hidden here in superb misdirection, and that all they had to do to get off the Ringworld was... It was a thin entertainment. Louis schooled himself to memorize the pattern of the city. It might be important. This was the first place they had found with any sign of a still-active civilization. He was taking a break, maybe an hour later. He was sitting on the dirty oval bunk, staring back at the eye, and beyond the eye, well to the side, was a tiny, vivid gray-brown triangle. "Hmm," Louis said softly. The triangle was only just big enough to be visible as such. It was set squarely in the gray-white chaos of the infinity horizon, which meant that it was still day there, although he was looking almost directly to starboard. Louis went for his binoculars. The binoculars made every detail as clear and sharp as the craters of the moon. An irregular triangle, red-brown near the base, bright as dirty snow near the apex. Fist of God. Vastly larger than they had thought. To be visible this far away, most of the mountain must project above the atmosphere. The flycycle fleet had flown around 150,000 miles since the crash. Fist of God had to be at least 1,000 miles high. Louis whistled. Again, he raised the binoculars. Sitting there in the near darkness, Louis gradually became aware of noises overhead. He stuck his head up out of the cell. Speaker to Animals roared, "Welcome, Louis!" He waved at him with the raw, red, half-eaten carcass of something approximately goat-sized. He took a bite the size of a Chateaubriand steak, immediately took another and another. His teeth were for tearing, not for chewing. He reached out to pick up a bloody-ended hind leg with the hoof and skin still on.
"We saved some for you, Louis. It has been hours dead, but no matter. We should hurry. The leaf-eater prefers not to watch us eat. He's sampling the view from my cell."
"Wait till he sees mine," said Louis. "We were wrong about Fist of God, Speaker. It's at least 1,000 miles high. The peak isn't snow-covered, it—"
"Louis, eat."
Louis found his mouth watering. "There has to be some way to cook that thing." There was. He got Speaker to tear the skin off for him, then wedged the hoof of the beast into a broken stair, stood back and roasted the meat with a flashlight laser turned to high intensity, wide aperture.
"The meat is not fresh," Speaker said dubiously, "but cremation is not the answer."
"How's Nessus? Is he a prisoner, or is he in control?"
"In partial control, I think. Look up."
The spacer girl was a tiny doll figure on the observation platform, her feet trailing in space, her face and scalp showing white as she looked down.
"You see, she will not let him out of her sight."
Louis decided the meat was ready. As he ate, he was aware that Speaker watched him without patience, watched as Louis Wu slowly masticated each small bite. But to Louis it seemed that he ate like a ravening beast. He was hungry. For the puppeteer's sake, they pushed the bones through the broken window to fall on the city. They reconvened around the puppeteer's fly cycle.
"She is partially conditioned," said Nessus. He was having trouble with his breathing, or with the smells of raw and burnt animal. "I have learned a good deal from her."
"Did you learn why she mouse-trapped us?"
"Yes, and more. We have been lucky. She is a spacer, a ramship crewman."
"Jackpot," said Louis Wu. Chapter 21. The Girl from Beyond the Edge. Her name was Halerloprillilar Hotrufan. She had been riding the ramship, Pioneer, Nessus called it after slight hesitation, for 200 years. The Pioneer ran a 24-year cycle that covered 4 suns and their systems, 5 oxygen-atmosphere worlds and the ring world. The year used was a traditional measurement which had nothing to do with the ring world. It may have matched the solar orbit for one of the abandoned worlds. 2 of the Pioneer's 5 worlds had been thick with humanity before the ring world was built. Now they were abandoned like the others, covered with random vegetation and the debris of crumbling cities. Halerloprillilar had run the cycle 8 times. She knew that on these worlds grew plants or animals which had not adapted to the ring world because of the lack of a winter-summer cycle. Some plants were spices, some animals were meat. Otherwise, Halerloprillilar neither knew nor cared. Her job had nothing to do with cargoes.
"Nor was she concerned with propulsion or life support. I was unable to learn just what she did," said Nessus. "The Pioneer carried a crew of 36. Doubtless, some were superfluous. Certainly she could have done nothing complex nor crucial to the well-being of ship or crew. She is not very intelligent, Louis."
"Did you think to ask about the ratio of sexes aboard ship? How many of the 36 were women?"
"She told me that. 3.
"You might as well forget about her profession."
200 years of travel, security, adventure. Then, at the end of Halerloprillilar's 8th run, the ring world refused to answer the Pioneer's call. The electromagnetic cannon didn't work. As far as telescopes could determine, there was no sign of activity at any spaceport. The 5 worlds of the Pioneer's circuit were not equipped with electromagnetic cannons for braking. Therefore, the Pioneer carried braking fuel, condensed en route from interstellar hydrogen. The ship could land, but where? Not on the ring world. The meteor defenses would blow them apart. They had not received permission to land on the spaceport ledge. And something was wrong there. Back to one of the abandoned home worlds? In effect, they would be starting a new colony world with 33 men and 3 women.
"They were hidebound prisoners of routine, ill-equipped to make such a decision. They panicked, said Nessus. They mutinied. The Pioneer's pilot managed to lock himself in the control room long enough to land the Pioneer on the spaceport ledge. They murdered him for it, for risking the ship and their lives, says Halorloprilalar. I wonder if they did not in truth murder him for breaking tradition, for landing by rocket and without formal permission.
Louis felt eyes on him. He looked up.
The spacer girl was still watching them, and Nessus was looking back at her with one head, the left.
So that one held the TASP, and that was why Nessus had been looking steadily upward. She wouldn't let Nessus out of her sight, and he dared not let her off the TASP's lovely hook.
After the killing of the pilot, they left the ship, said Nessus. Then it was that they learned how badly the pilot had hurt them. The Chiltang Brone was inert, broken. They were stranded on the wrong side of a wall 1,000 miles high. I do not know the equivalent of Chiltang Brone in Interworld or the Hero's Tongue. I can only tell you what it does. What it does is crucial to us all.
Go ahead, said Louis Wu.
The Ringworld engineers had designed Failsafe. In many ways, it seemed that they had anticipated the fall of civilization, had planned for it, as if cycles of culture and barbarism were man's natural lot. The complex structure that was the Ringworld would not fail for lack of tending. The descendants of the engineers might forget how to tend airlocks and electromagnetic cannon, how to move worlds and build flying cars. Civilization might end, but the Ringworld would not. The meteor defenses, for instance, were so utterly fail-safe that Halorloprilalar...
Call her Prill, Louis suggested.
That Prill and her crew never considered that they might not be working. But what of the spaceport? How fail-safe would it be if some idiot left both doors of the airlock open? There weren't any airlocks. Instead, there was the Chiltang Brone. This machine projected a field which caused the structure of the Ringworld floor, and hence of the rim wall, to become permeable matter. There was some resistance. While the Chiltang Brone was going...
Osmosis generator, Louis suggested.
Perhaps. I suspect that Brone is a modifier, possibly obscene.
Air would leak through, but slowly, while the osmosis generator was going. Men could push through in pressure suits, moving as against a steady wind. Machines and large masses could be drawn through by tractors.
What of pressurized breathing air? Speaker asked.
But they made that outside, with the transmuters. Yes, there was cheap transmutation on the Ringworld. It was cheap only in great quantity, and there were other limits. The machine itself was gigantic. It could make just one element into just one other element. The spaceport's two transmuters would turn lead into nitrogen and oxygen. Lead was easy to store and easy to move through the rim wall. The osmosis generators were a fail-safe device. When an airlock fails, a veritable hurricane of breathing air can be lost. But if the Chiltang Brone broke down, the worst that could happen would be that the airlock would be closed to space, and, incidentally, to returning spacemen.
Also to us, said Speaker.
Louis said, Not so fast. It sounds like the osmosis generator is just what we need to get home. We wouldn't have to move the lyre at all. Just point the Chiltang Brone, he pronounced it as if it started with a sneeze, at the ring floor under the lyre. The lyre would sink through the ring floor like quicksand. Down and out the other side.
To be trapped in the foamed plastic meteor buffer, the Kazin retorted. Then, correction, the slaver weapon might serve us there.
Quite so. Unfortunately, said Nessus, there is no Chiltang Brone available to us.
She's here. She got through somehow.
Yes.
The magneto-hydrodynamicists virtually had to learn a new profession before they could begin to rebuild the Chiltang Brone. It took them several years. The machine had failed in action. It was partly twisted and partly melted. They had to make new parts, recalibrate, use elements they knew would fail, but maybe they'd hold long enough. There was an accident during that time. An osmosis beam, modified by bad calibration, went through the Pioneer. Two crewmen died waist-deep in a metal floor, and 17 others suffered permanent brain damage in addition to other injuries when certain permeable membranes became too permeable. But they got through, the remaining 16. They took the idiots with them. They also took the Chiltang Brone in case the new ring world turned out to be inhospitable. They found savagery. Nothing but savagery. Years later, some of them tried to go back. The Chiltang Brone failed in action, trapping four of them in the rim wall, and that was that. By then, they knew that there would be no new parts available anywhere on the ring world.
"I don't understand how barbarism could come so fast," said Louis. "You said the Pioneer ran a 24-year cycle?"
24 years in ship's time, Louis.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Yes. To a ship traveling at one ring-world gravity of thrust, stars tend to be 3 to 6 years apart. The actual distances were large. Prill speaks of an abandoned region 200 light-years closer to the mean galactic plane, where three suns clustered within 10 light-years of each other.
200 light-years? Near human space, do you think?
Perhaps in human space. Oxygen atmosphere planets do not in general tend to cluster as closely as they do in the vicinity of Sol. Haller Loprilalar speaks of long-term terraforming techniques applied to these worlds, many centuries before the building of the ring world. These techniques took too long. They were abandoned halfway by the impatient humans.
That would explain a lot, except... No, never mind.
Primates, Louis? There is evidence enough that your species evolved on Earth, but Earth might have been a convenient base for a terraforming project aimed at worlds in nearby systems. The engineers might have brought pets and servants.
Like apes and monkeys and Neanderthals? Louis made a chopping gesture. It's just speculation. It's not something we need to know.
Granted.
The puppeteer munched a vegetable brick while he talked.
The loop followed by the Pioneer was more than 300 light-years long. There was time for extensive change during a voyage, though such change was rare. Prill's society was a stable one.
Why was she so sure that the whole ring world had gone barbarian? How much exploring did they do?
Very little, but enough. Prill was right. There will be no repairs for the Chiltang Brone. The entire ring world must be barbarous by now.
How?
Prill tried to explain to me what happened here, as one of her crew explained it to her. He had oversimplified, of course. It may be that the process started years before the Pioneer departed on its last circuit.
There had been 10 inhabited worlds. When the ring world was finished, all of these had been abandoned, left to go their way without the benefit of man. Consider such a world. The land is covered with cities in all stages of development. Perhaps slums were made obsolete, but somewhere there are still slums, if only preserved for history. Across the land, one can find all the byproducts of living. Used containers, broken machines, damaged books or film tapes or scrolls, anything that cannot be reused or reprocessed at a profit, and many things which could be. The seas have been used as garbage dumps for 100,000 years. Somewhere in that time, they were dumping useless radioactive end products of fission. How strange is it if the sea life evolves to fit the new conditions? How strange if new life evolves capable of living on the garbage?
That happened on Earth once, said Louis Wu. A yeast that could eat polyethylene. It was eating the plastic bags off the supermarket shelves. It's dead now. We had to give up polyethylene.
Consider 10 such worlds. Bacteria evolved to eat zinc compounds, plastics, paints, wiring insulation, fresh rubbish, and rubbish thousands of years obsolete. It would not have mattered but for the ramships. The ramships came routinely to the old worlds, seeking forms of life that had been forgotten or that had not adapted to the ring world. They brought back other things, souvenirs, objets d'art which had been forgotten or merely postponed. Many museums were still being transferred,
one incredibly valuable piece at a time. One of the ram ships brought back a mold capable of breaking down the structure of a room-temperature superconductor much used in sophisticated machinery. The mold worked slowly. It was young and primitive and, in the beginning, easily killed. Variations may have been brought to the ring world several times by several ships, until one variation finally took hold. Because it did work slowly, it did not ruin the ramship until long after the ramship had landed. It did not destroy the spaceport's Chiltang Brone until crewmen and spaceport workmen had carried it inside. It did not get into the power beam receivers until the shuttles that traveled through the electromagnetic cannon on the rim wall had carried it everywhere on the ring world.
Power beam receivers?
Power is generated on the shadow squares by thermoelectricity, then beamed to the ring world. Presumably the beam, too, is failsafe. We did not detect it coming in. It must have shut itself down when the receivers failed.
Surely, said Speaker, one could make a different superconductor. We know of two basic molecular structures, each with many variations for different temperature ranges.
There are at least four basic structures, Nessus corrected him. You are quite right. The ring world should have survived the fall of the cities. A younger, more vigorous society would have, but consider the difficulties they faced. Much of their leadership was dead, killed in falling buildings when the power failed. Without power, they could do little experimenting to find other superconductors. Stored power was generally confiscated for the personal use of men with political power, or was used to run enclaves of civilization in the hope that someone else was doing something about the emergency. The fusion drives of the RAN ships were unavailable, as the Chiltang Brones used superconductors. Men who might have accomplished something could not meet. The computer that ran the electromagnetic cannon was dead, and the cannon itself had no power.
Louis said, "For want of a nail, the kingdom fell."
"I know the story. It is not strictly applicable," said Nessus. "Something could have been done. There was power to condense liquid helium. With the power beams off, the repair of a power receiver would have been useless, but a Chiltang Brone could have been adapted to a metal superconductor cooled by liquid helium. A Chiltang Brone would have given access to spaceports. Ships might have flown to the shadow squares, reopened the power beams so that other liquid helium-cooled superconductors could be adapted to the power beam receivers. But all this would have required stored power. The power was used to light street lamps, or to support the remaining floating buildings, or to cook meals and freeze foods. And so the ring world fell.
"And so did we," said Louis Wu.
"Yes. We were lucky to run across Halorloprilalar. She has saved us a needless journey. There is no longer any need to continue toward the rim wall."
Louis's head throbbed once, hard. He was going to have a headache. "Lucky," said Speaker to Animals. "Indeed. If this is luck, why am I not joyful? We have lost our goal, our last meager hope of escape. Our vehicles are ruined. One of our party is missing in this maze of city." "Dead," said Louis. When they looked at him without comprehension, he pointed into the dusk. Teela's fly cycle was obvious enough, marked by one of four sets of headlamps. He said, "We'll have to make our own luck from now on."
"Yes. You will remember, Louis, that Teela's luck is sporadic. It had to be, else she would not have been aboard the Lyre. Else we would not have crashed."
The puppeteer paused, then added,
"My sympathies, Louis."
"She will be missed," Speaker rumbled.
Louis nodded. It seemed he should be feeling more, but the incident in the ice storm had somehow altered his feelings for Teela. She had seemed, for that time, less human than Speaker or Nessus. She was myth. The aliens were real.
"We must find a new goal," said Speaker to Animals. "We need a way to take the Lyre back to space. I confess I have no ideas at all."
"I do," Louis said. Speaker seemed startled.
"Already?"
"I want to think about it some more. I'm not sure it's even sane, let alone workable. In any case, we're going to need a vehicle. Let's think about that."
"A sled, perhaps. We can use the remaining fly cycle to tow it. A big sled, perhaps the wall of a building."
"We can do better than that. I am convinced that I can persuade Halorloprilalar to guide me through the machinery that lifts this building. we may find that the building itself can become our vehicle.
Try that, said Louis.
And you?
Give me time. The core of the building was all machinery. Some was lifting machinery, some ran the air conditioning and the water condensers and the water taps. And one insulated section was part of the electromagnetic trap generators. Nessus worked. Louis and Prill stood by, awkwardly ignoring one another. Speaker was still in prison. Prill had refused to let him up.
She is afraid of you, Nessus had said. We could press the point, no doubt. We could put you aboard one of the fly cycles. If I refused to board until you were on the platform, she would have to lift you.
She might lift me halfway to the ceiling, then drop me. No.
But she had taken Louis. He studied her while pretending to ignore her. Her mouth was narrow, virtually lipless. Her nose was small and straight and narrow. She had no eyebrows. Small wonder if she seemed to have no expression. Her face seemed little more than markings on a wigmaker's dummy. After 2 hours of work, Nessus pulled his hands out of an access panel.
I cannot give us motive power. The lift fields will do no more than lift us. But I have freed a correcting mechanism designed to keep us over one spot. The building is now at the mercy of the winds.
Louis grinned. Or a tow. Tie a line to your fly cycle and pull the building behind you.
There is no need. The fly cycle uses a reactionless thruster. We can keep it within the building.
You thought of it first, huh? But that thruster's awfully powerful. If the cycle tore itself loose in here...
Yes.
The puppeteer turned to Prill and spoke slowly and at length in the language of the Ringworld gods. Presently he said to Louis,
There is a supply of electrosetting plastic. We can embed the fly cycle in plastic, leaving only the controls exposed.
Isn't that a little drastic?
Louis, if the fly cycle tore itself loose, I could be hurt.
Well, maybe. Can you land the building when you need to?
Yes, I have altitude control.
Then we don't need a scout vehicle. Okay, we'll do it.
Louis was resting, not sleeping. He lay on his back on the big oval bed. His eyes were open, staring through the bubble window in the ceiling. A glow of solar corona showed over the edge of the shadow square. Dawn was not far off, but still the arch was blue and bright in a black sky.
I must be out of my mind, said Louis Wu. And what else can we do?
The bedroom had been part of the governor's suite. Now it was a control room. He and Nessus had mounted the fly cycle in the walk-in closet, poured plastic over and around it, then, with Prill's help, run a current through the plastic. The closet had been just the right size. The bed smelled of age. It crinkled when he moved.
Fist of God, Louis Wu said into the dark.
I saw it, 1,000 miles high. It doesn't make sense they'd build a mountain that high, not when... He let it trail off. And suddenly sat bolt upright in bed, shouting,
Shadow square wire!
A shadow entered the room. Louis froze. The entrance was dark. Yet by its fluid motion and by the distribution of subtle shadings of curvature, a naked woman was walking toward him. Hallucination? The ghost of Teela Brown? She had reached him before he could decide. Totally self-confident, she sat beside him on the bed. She reached out and touched his face and ran her fingertips down his cheek. She was nearly bald. Though her hair was dark and long and full-bodied so that it bobbed as she walked, it was only an inch-wide fringe growing from the base of her skull. In the dark, the features of her face virtually disappeared, but her body was lovely. He was seeing the shape of her for the first time. She was slim, muscled, with wire like a professional dancer. Her breasts were high and heavy. If her face had matched her figure... Go away, Louis said, not roughly. He took her wrist, interrupted what her fingertips were doing to his face. It had felt like a barber's facial massage, infinitely relaxing. He stood up, pulled her gently to her feet, took her by the shoulders. If he simply turned her around and patted her on the rump? She ran her fingertips along the side of his neck.
Now she was using both hands. She touched him on the chest, and here, and there, and suddenly Louis Wu was blind with lust. His hands closed like clamps on her shoulders. She dropped her hands. She waited without trying to help as he peeled out of his falling jumper. But as he exposed more skin, she stroked him here and there, not always where nerves clustered. Each time it was as if she had touched him in the pleasure center of his brain. He was on fire. If she pushed him away now, he would use force. He must have her. But some cool part of him knew that she could chill him as quickly as she had aroused him. He felt like a young satyr, yet he dimly sensed that he was also a puppet. For the moment, he couldn't have cared less. And still, Prill's face showed no expression. She took him to the verge of orgasm, then held him there. Held him there, so that when the moment came, it was like being struck by lightning. But the lightning went on and on, a flaming discharge of ecstasy. When it ended, he was barely aware that she was leaving. She must know how thoroughly she had used him up. He was asleep before she reached the door. And he woke, thinking, why did she do that? "Too tange analytical," he answered himself. "She's lonely. She must have been here for a long time. She's mastered a skill, and she hasn't had a chance to practice that skill. Skill. She must know more anatomy than most professors. A doctorate in prostitution. There was more to the oldest profession than met the eye. Louis Wu could recognize expertise in any field. This woman had it. Touch these nerves in the correct order, and the subject will react thus and so. The right knowledge can turn a man into a puppet. Puppet to Tila's luck. He almost had it then. He came close enough that the answer, when it finally came, was no surprise. Nessus and Hallorlo Prillalar came backward out of the freezer room. They were followed by the dressed carcass of a flightless bird bigger than a man. Nessus had used a cloth for padding so that his mouth need not touch the dead meat of the ankle. Louis took the puppeteer's burden. He and Prill pulled in tandem. He found that he needed both hands, as did she. He answered her nod of greeting and asked, "How old is she?" Nessus did not show surprise at the question. "I do not know. She came to my room last night." That would not do. It would mean nothing to an alien. You know that the thing we do to reproduce, we also do for recreation."
"I knew that."
"We did that. She's good at it." "She's so good at it that she must have had about 1,000 years of practice," said Louis Wu.
"It is not impossible. Prill's civilization had a compound superior to booster spice in its ability to sustain life. Today the compound is worth whatever the owner cares to ask. One charge is equivalent to some 50 years of youth."
"Do you happen to know how many charges she's taken?"
"No, Louis, but I know that she walked here."
They had reached the stairway leading down to the conical cell block. The bird trailed behind them, bouncing. "Walked here from where?"
"From the rim wall."
200,000 miles?
"Nearly that."
"Tell me all of it. What happened to them after they reached the right side of the rim wall?"
"I will ask. I do not know at all."
And the puppeteer began to question Prill. In bits and pieces, the story emerged. They were taken for gods by the first group of savages they met, and by everyone thereafter, with one general exception. Godhood solved one problem neatly. The crewmen whose brains had been damaged by backlash from the half-repaired Chiltang Brone were left to the care of various villages. As resident gods, they would be well treated, and as idiots, they would be relatively harmless as gods. The remainder of the Pioneer's crew split up. 9, including Prill, went to Anti-Spinward. Prill's home city was in that direction. Both groups planned to travel along the rim wall, looking for civilization. Both parties swore to send help if they found any. They were taken for gods by all but the other gods. The fall of the cities had left a few survivors. Some were mad. All took the life-extending compound if they could get it. All were looking for enclaves of civilization. None had thought to build his own.
As the Pioneer's crew moved to anti-Spinward, other survivors joined them. They became a respectable pantheon. In every city they found the shattered towers. These towers had been set floating after the settling of the Ringworld, but thousands of years before the perfection of the youth drug. The youth drug had made later generations cautious. For the most part, those who could afford it simply stayed away from the floaters unless they were elected officials. Then they would install safety devices or power generators. A few of the floaters still floated, but most had smashed down into the centers of cities, all in the same instant when the last power receiver flared and died. Once, the traveling pantheon found a partially re-civilized city, inhabited only on the outskirts. The God Gambit would not serve them here. They traded a fortune in the youth drug for a working, self-powered bus. It did not happen again until much later. By then they had come too far. The spirit had gone out of them, and the bus had broken down. In a half-smashed city, among other survivors of the fall of the cities, most of the pantheon simply stopped moving. But Pril had a map. The city of her birth was directly to starboard. She persuaded a man to join her, and they started walking. They traded on their godhoods. Eventually they tired of one another, and Pril went on alone. Where her godhood was not enough, she traded small quantities of the youth drug if she had to. Otherwise,
there was another way in which she could maintain power over people. She has tried to explain it to me, but I do not understand.
I think I do, said Louis. She could get away with it, too. She's got her own equivalent of a TASP.
She must have been quite mad by the time she reached her home city. She took up residence in the grounded police station. She spent hundreds of hours learning how to work the machinery. One of the first things she accomplished was to get it airborne, for the self-powered tower had been landed as a safety precaution after the fall of the cities. Subsequently, she must have come close enough to dropping the tower and killing herself.
There was a system for trapping drivers who broke the traffic laws, Nessus finished. She turned it on. She hopes to capture someone like herself, a survivor from the fall of the cities. She reasons that if he is flying a car, he must be civilized.
Then why does she want him trapped and helpless in that sea of rusted metal?
Just in case, Louis. It is a mark of her returning sanity.
Louis frowned into the cell block below. They had lowered the bird's carcass on a ruined metal car, and Speaker had taken possession.
We can lighten this building, said Louis. We can cut the weight almost in half.
How?
Cut away the basement. But we'll have to get Speaker out of there. Can you persuade Pril?
I can try.
Chapter 22 Seeker Haller-Loprillilar was terrified of Speaker, and Nessus was leery of letting her out of the influence of the TASP. Nessus claimed to be jumping the TASP on her every time she saw Speaker, so that eventually she would welcome the sight of him. Meanwhile, they both shunned the Kazin's company. So it was that Pril and Nessus waited elsewhere, while Louis and Speaker lay flat on the floor of the observation platform, looking down into the gloom of the cell block.
"Go ahead," said Louis.
The Kazin fired both beams. Thunder boomed and echoed within the cell block. A brilliant point the color of lightning appeared high on the wall, just beneath the ceiling. It moved slowly clockwise, leaving a redly glowing trail.
"Cut chunks," Louis directed. "If that mass lets go all at once, we'll be shaken loose like fleas on a shaven dog."
Speaker obligingly changed the angle of his cutting. Still, the building lurched when the first chunk of cable and construction plastic fell away. Louis hugged the floor. Through the gap he saw sunlight, and city, and people. He did not have a view straight down until half a dozen masses had been cut loose. He saw an altar of wood and a model of silvery metal, whose shape was a flat rectangle surmounted by a parabolic arch. It was there for an instant before a mass of cell block structure struck next to it and splashed fragments in all directions. Then it was sawdust and crumpled tinsel. But the people had fled long since.
"People," he complained to Nessus. "In the heart of an empty city, miles from the fields. That's an all-day round trip. What were they doing there?"
"They worship the goddess Haller-Loprillilar. They are Pril's food source."
Ah, offerings.
Of course. What difference does it make, Louis?
They might have been hit.
Perhaps some of them were.
And I thought I saw Teela down there, just for an instant.
Nonsense, Louis. Shall we test our motive power?
The puppeteer's flycycle was buried in a gelatinous mound of translucent plastic. Nessus stood alongside the exposed control panel. The bay window gave them an imposing view of the city, the docks, the flat-sided towers of the civic center, the spreading jungle that had probably been a park, all several thousand feet below. Louis struck an attitude. Parade rest. An inspiration to his crew. The heroic commander stands astride the bridge. The damaged rocket motors may explode at the first touch of thrust, but it must be tried. The Kazinti battleships must be stopped before they reach Earth.
"It'll never work," said Louis Wu.
"Why not, Louis? The stresses should not exceed..."
"A flying castle, for Finnegal's sake! I only just realized how insane the whole thing is. We must have been out of our minds, tootling home in the upper half of a skyscraper."
The building shifted then, and Louis staggered. Nessus had started the thruster. The city drifted past the bay window, gathering speed. Acceleration eased off. It had never been higher than a foot per second squared. Top speed seemed to be about 100 miles per hour, and the castle was rock steady.
"We centered the fly cycle correctly," said Nessus. "The floor is level, as you will note, and the structure shows no tendency to rotate."
"It's still silly."
"Nothing that works is silly. And now, where shall we go?"
Louis was silent.
"Where shall we go, Louis? Speaker and I have no plans. What direction, Louis?"
"Starboard."
"Very well. Directly starboard?"
"Right. We've got to get past the eye storm. Then turn 45 degrees or so to anti-spinward."
"Do you seek the city of the tower called Heaven?"
"Yes. Can you find it?"
"That should be no problem, Louis. 3 hours flying time brought us here. We should be back at the tower in 30 hours. And then?"
"Depends." The picture was so vivid. It was pure deduction and imagination, yet so vivid. Louis Wu tended to daydream in color. So vivid. But was it real? It was frightening how suddenly his confidence in the flying tower had leaked away. Yet the tower was flying. It didn't need Louis Wu to make it go.
"The leaf-eater seems content to follow your lead," said Speaker.
The flycycle hummed quietly to itself a few feet away. Landscape flowed past the bay window. The eye storm was off to the side, its gray gaze large and daunting.
"The leaf-eater's out of his mind," said Louis. "I take it you've got better sense."
"Not at all. If you have a goal, I am content to follow you. But if it may involve fighting, I should know something about it." "I should know something about it regardless, in order to decide whether it will involve fighting."
"Well put."
Speaker waited.
"We're going after the Shadow Square wire," said Louis. "Remember the wire we ran into after the meteor defenses wrecked us? Later it started falling over the city of the floating tower, loop after loop, endlessly. There should be at least tens of thousands of miles of it, more than we could possibly need for what I've got in mind."
"What do you have in mind, Louis?"
"Getting hold of the Shadow Square wire. Odds are the natives will just give it to us if Prill asks politely, and if Nessus uses the TASP."
"And after that?"
"After that, we'll find out just how crazy I am."
The tower moved to starboard like a steamship of the sky. Starships were never so roomy. As for ships of the air, there was nothing comparable in known space. 6 decks to climb around in. Luxury. There were luxuries missing. The food supply aboard the flyscraper consisted of frozen meat, perishable fruit, and the kitchen of Nessus's fly cycle. Food for puppeteers lacked nourishment for humans, according to Nessus. Thus, Louis's breakfast and lunch were meat broiled by a flashlight blazer and knobbly red fruit. And there was no water. And no coffee. Prill was persuaded to find some bottles of an alcoholic beverage. They held a belated christening ceremony in the bridge room, with Speaker courteously backed into a far corner and Prill hovering warily near the door. Nobody would accept Louis's suggestion of the name Improbable. And so there were four christenings, in order, in four different languages. The beverage was, well, sour. Speaker couldn't take it, and Nessus didn't try. But Prill consumed one bottle, sealed the others, and put them carefully away. The christening became a language lesson. Louis learned a few of the rudiments of the Ringworld engineer's speech. He found that Speaker was learning much faster than he was. It figured. Speaker and Nessus had both been trained to deal with human languages, modes of thinking, limitations in speech and hearing. This was only more of the same. They broke for dinner. Again, Nessus ate alone, using his fly-cycle kitchen, while Louis and Prill ate broiled meat and Speaker ate raw, elsewhere. Afterward, the language lesson went on. Louis hated it. The others were so far ahead of him that he felt like a cretin.
"But, Louis, we must learn the language. Our rate of travel is low, and we must forage for our food. Frequently, we will need to deal with natives."
"I know. I never liked languages." Darkness fell. Even this far from the eye storm, cloud cover was complete, and the night was like the inside of a dragon's mouth. Louis called a halt to the lesson. He was tired and irritable and vastly unsure of himself. The others left him to his rest. They would be passing the eye storm in about 10 hours. He was floating at the edge of a restless sleep when Prill came back. He felt hands stroking him lasciviously, and he reached out. She backed out of reach. She spoke in her own language, but simplified it into a pidgin for Louis's understanding.
"You are leader?"
Bleary-eyed, Louis considered. "Yes," he said, because the actual situation was too complex.
"Make the two-headed one give me his machine."
What? Louis fumbled for words. His which?
His machine that make me happy. I want it. You take it from him.
Louis laughed, for he thought he understood her.
You want me? You take it, Prill said angrily.
The puppeteer had something she wanted. She had no lever to use on him, for he was not a man. Louis Wu was the only man around. Her power would bend him to her will. It had always worked before, for was she not a goddess? Perhaps Louis's hair had misled her. She may have assumed that he was one of the hairy lower class by his bare face, perhaps half-engineer, but no more. Then he must have been born after the fall of the cities. No youth drug. He must be in the first flush of youth. "You were quite right," Louis said in his own tongue. Prill's fists clenched in anger, for his mockery was clear. "A 30-year-old man would be putty in your hands, but I'm older than that." And he laughed again.
"The machine. Where does he keep it?"
In the darkness, she leaned toward him, all lovely suggestive shadow. Her scalp gleamed softly. Her black hair spilled over her shoulder. The breath caught in Louis's throat. He found the words to say, "Glue against his bone, under skin. One head." Prill made a sound like a growl. She must have understood. The gadget was surgically implanted. She turned and left. Louis thought briefly of following her. He wanted her more than he was willing to admit. But she would own him if he let her, and her motives did not jibe with Louis Wu's. The whistle of the wind rose gradually. Louis's sleep became shallow and merged into an erotic dream. His eyes opened. Prill knelt, facing him, straddling him like a succubus. Her fingers moved lightly over the skin of his chest and belly. Her hips moved rhythmically, and Louis moved in response. She was playing him like a musical instrument.
"When I finish, I will own you," she crooned.
The pleasure showed in her voice, but it was not the pleasure of a woman taking pleasure from a man. It was the thrill of wielding power. Her touch was a joy as thick as syrup. She knew a terribly ancient secret, that every woman is born with a tasp, and that its power is without limit if she can learn to use it. She would use it and withhold it, use it and withhold it, until Louis begged for the right to serve her. Something changed in her. Her face could not show it, but he heard the crooning sound of her pleasure,
and he felt the change in her motion. She moved, and they came together, and the slam that rolled across them then seemed entirely subjective. She lay beside him all that night.